Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary. Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Well, actually, I believe it was big swinging dicks. So there was obviously an overexcited imagination on the part of some, I would suggest.
Because if he wants to know what misogyny looks like in modern Australia, he doesn't need a motion in the House of Representatives. He needs a mirror.
I love the mansplaining. I'm enjoying it.
What's mansplaining, Senator?
Welcome back to In the House and In the Senate, where we talk to the women of Australian politics about who they are, what they do, and why it matters. In the House and In the Senate is supported by Plan International Australia, the charity for girls' equality. As a leading humanitarian organisation working in 80 countries, Plan International Australia tackles poverty and supports communities through crisis. Plan work on some of the most important issues of our time, from gender equality, sexual and reproductive health rights, sexual harassment, and action on the climate crisis. I'm your host, Alicia Aiken-Radburn. I'm a former federal and state political staffer, passionate about making a positive change in our world. Let's get into today's episode. Dr. Anne Ali is the Labor member for Cowan in Western Australia. Dr. Ali is an internationally renowned expert in counter-terrorism and counter-radicalisation. She has published over 100 articles and books on topics related to terrorism and international security. Dr. Ali has worked with the United Nations on developing programs and policies on national security and counter-terrorism, and was the only Australian to be invited to President Obama's White House Conference on Violent Extremism in 2015. She has received numerous awards for her work, and in 2016 she was awarded the Australian Security Medal. She raised her 2 sons as a single mother, she's a survivor of domestic abuse, and now she advocates for others as one of the most vivacious, compassionate parliamentarians in federal parliament. And thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Alicia.
It's really meaningful for me to have you here. I just think that you are such a... What I try and do with this podcast a little bit is to inject personality into politics. And I think that you are just a standout of really retaining your own sense of self within politics. What do you think about that? Do you feel that way?
Yeah, I do actually. I think that, when I first agreed to run for Cowan, I remember sitting there with my husband and watching, and I'd never been politically active or particularly politically interested before that. But, you know, suddenly we were watching, you know, politics and politicians. And I remember seeing one politician on the television, and he'd gone up to someone and to shake their hand and said, you know, I'm so-and-so, are you going to vote for me? And I turned to my husband and I said, oh my gosh, if I ever turn into that, you need to tell me it's time to leave. So I really, like, from the very beginning, made sure that I had support structures around me who would ground me, because at the end of it, when I leave politics, I'm still Anne.
Yes.
And I still need to be Anne. And I really don't know any other way to be honest. So I think it's really important that you don't let the political system beat you into being something that you're not. It's a challenge, but I think it's vital today, and I think it's really vital to increase that level of public trust in politics that we've seen diminish in Australia, particularly over the last two decades or so.
Why do you think it is? Why do you think that politics, I think that particularly young people look at politics and they're like, everyone is so boring and restricted and risk averse.
Yeah.
Why don't you think, because I've worked with politicians and parliamentarians aren't necessarily boring people. So they're some of the like nicest, you know, this is not across the board.
No, not all of them.
But a lot of them do have fabulous personalities.
Yeah.
And then it feels like that's not really conveyed to the Australian public. Yeah. Why do you think that is?
I agree with you. I went to a school the other day and I was addressing like 200 year 9 and year 10 students. And the first question I asked them was, put your hand up if you think that our parliament represents you. One hand went up. One hand. And I think that's the thing is I think that, you know, with the 24-hour news cycle and the kind of the media performance pressure and, you know, the lines that you have to put out there, you kind of lose that in how you or you can lose that in how you portray yourself to the media, which is why I think when somebody comes along and they're quite sincere in the media and they're, you know, they're funny and they don't stick to the lines, people find that quite interesting.
Totally.
It doesn't necessarily do you a lot of favours inside the political system, but I think if we have this cultural change that I think we need to be seeing in politics, I think we need to give ourselves permission as politicians to be more than just a politician, to be more than just a face, to actually share stories, give the public a little bit of insight into who we are, into our personality, into our private lives even. You don't have to give everything. I certainly haven't given everything, but I've certainly shared my story and my struggles. And I've been just overwhelmed and amazed at how many people have reached out to me. Like, you know, men in their 60s who I would think have nothing in common with me have reached out and said, you know, I read your book or I listened to you talking about your life story, and it meant this and this and this to me. And it's quite heartwarming, overwhelming, astounding, and actually also a real privilege to know that you can reach out and find a connection with people that you probably thought you never had a connection with.
Can you paint us a little bit of a picture, Anne, of what your life was before politics? Like, tell us a little bit about that life story that, you know, that 60-year-old man has found something within and has reached out to you about.
Well, so my parents came to Australia when I was two from Egypt. My background is Egyptian, and I've recently found out that I've got Moroccan heritage as well on my mother's side. I know, so cool. And I went to Morocco and everything. It was fabulous. And so it was very typical kind of migrant upbringing in the 70s. Parents went to work. Dad worked in a factory and then later as a bus driver. Mum was a nurse's aide. So they always worked shift work. My brother and my sister and I would come home to an empty house, and you know, that was just the kind of the latchkey kid migrant story. Mm-hmm. Finished high school in Sydney, went back to Egypt, ended up doing my first university degree there, got married, came back to Australia, had two kids, and all of this by the time I was 25.
Wow.
I know, right? Because at 21, I thought I knew everything. And then found myself fleeing a violent relationship and raising my two boys, Adam and Kareem, on my own. Really hard times financially. So I was on welfare. I know what it's like to be on welfare, on a limited income. Went back to uni, studied a postgraduate and then a master's, and then went to work as soon as I could and raised my boys, basically, and then went back at uni again because I'm a glutton for punishment, maybe, I don't know. Did my PhD and then eventually became a professor in counterterrorism. So I guess my pathway to politics isn't I know that a lot of people will tell you, oh, I didn't take the usual pathway to politics. I was a staffer. I was not that. You know? I wasn't a staffer. I wasn't a lawyer. I wasn't a member of a union or a unionist. I was a professor. And 2015 was like the height of my academic career. And I got asked to run. And I really had no idea what that meant or what that entailed. Very much a political outsider.
How did that happen? Like, did you have a connection with the party, or was it literally like, I remember back in that period as well, 2015, I feel like from memory you were also your area of specialty, counterterrorism, was really hot topic in the media. And I think I remember seeing you on Q&A even before your political days. What was it, just a cold call that you got?
Literally, I've got to tell you this story, because like, if you believe in serendipity or fate or whatever you believe in, this will make you believe. So February 2015, I'm visiting my dad at the nursing home, and I get this phone call from the US embassy going, and President Obama is having this conference at the White House and he'd like you to attend. And I'm like, let me check my diary.
Me too. I'm like, oh, sorry, just hold.
Just let me check.
I'll try and fit it in.
So February, I went to the White House as the only Australian civil society rep for the Countering Violent Extremism Summit for President Obama. And then later that year, and for me, I thought, wow, this is it. You know, I've made it. I'm at the White House. It's snowing. I've never seen snow before. People keep telling me you need to see snow. I'm like, why? It's cold. It's wet. That's all I need to know.
I love that that's what you're thinking about.
I know, right? Because I nearly died of hypothermia. It was that cold. And then later that year in August, I was invited as, again, the only Australian representative at the Club de Madrid Dialogues, which is a forum of former world leaders that was started by Kofi Annan and Bill Clinton. And then 3 weeks later, I had to be at the United Nations in Vienna because I was on the United Nations experts panel and as an advisor to them. So I took my husband, David, husband number three, just in case you didn't know. Well, there it is. And we went to Europe, and we started out in Madrid and ended in Vienna. But I went into the Club de Madrid thinking, wow, this is amazing. Like, here I am with all of these world leaders. I'm finally going to, you know, see some change happening and have some really substantial discussions. Well, this was a two-day forum, and within hours of the first day, it had descended into these world leaders blaming each other and pointing fingers. And so my role was to finish off the final segment in the conference, along with the head of the World Bank and the former Prime Minister of Ireland. And I stood up and I said, look, I came here with really high hopes, and each and every one of you had the power to change things, and you squandered that power.
Wow.
And I don't know why, but for some reason they haven't asked me back. Anyway, 3 weeks later I was in Vienna and doing 3 days of United Nations talks, where we had resolved to come up with guidelines for member states about terrorism and the judicial response. Mm-hmm. And I walked out of there that evening, and it was a cold November evening in Vienna, and Dave was standing on the stairs waiting for me in his coat, and you could see his breath in the cold air. And he looks at me, goes, are you finished? And I said, you know what, babe, I'm actually really finished. And he said, what do you mean? I said, you know, I spend my life traveling the world, attending all of these summits and these dialogues and these processes, but I'm going to go home to Australia and nothing's going to change because there's just no political will. So on the way back from a very cold Europe in November, we stopped off in Bali.
Love that. Yeah, good decision.
Very good decision. Because
particularly when you're feeling disillusioned with the whole world political system.
But also, darling, my people, we don't do snow.
Yeah, good.
So we get to Bali, and I'm literally lying in my bathers by the pool, and my phone rings. And you know when your phone rings, it's not a number you recognize, mm-hmm. and you're on holiday. I didn't answer it. A few minutes later, I get a text and it says, oh, hi, Anne, this is WA Labor. Can you give us a call? And I'm like, what did they want? And how did they get random. My number? So random. But my son, Adam,
yes.
who you know,
yes.
was Young Labor. So I rang Adam. And I'm like,
what's this all about?
I'm like, yeah, exactly. I'm like, Adam, I just got this message. What's it all about? And he goes, oh, Mum, I don't know. Maybe they want you to run in the next election.
Do you reckon he like had some whispers to like, everyone knows like I'm friends with Adam.
Yeah.
And everyone like talks about, oh my God, Adam's like rock star mom.
I don't know, but like Adam used to always, was always at me. And Mum joined the Labor Party. Mum joined the, I'm going, no, I'm not joining any political parties. And then one time he said to me, Mum, can you come and address Young Labor? And I'm like, why? Why don't you get someone important to do it? He finally talked me into it and I went and addressed Young Labor. But Adam goes to me, maybe they want you to run in the next election. I'm like, oh, there's an election? When? So came back to Perth, met with the Labor Party here and basically asked them that question. I said, why would I do this? Like, why would I leave my career? I've got, you know, an international reputation. I've got ARC grants. Mm-hmm. I've got a research centre, my own research centre. Wow. I've got enough research to last me the next 10 years and unpublished research that I have to get out there. Why would I leave all of that? And the response came back and it was like, because it would be a way to make change. And I went away and I thought about it and I spoke to my husband, I spoke to my kids, I spoke to my mom and my family. And thought, yeah, okay, let's do this. I'd never watched Question Time before in my life.
Probably for the best. You might have not done it.
Oh, my goodness. I walked in, like the first Question Time, I walked in with paper and pen and I'm like, oh, questions and answer time. I'm going to take notes. Literally now, every time Question Time is on, I'm like, what sins do I have to atone for that I have to sit through Question Time every day?
I just think that basically we're at the point that everyone points to it being such a toxic element of Parliament. You may as well just get rid of it.
Like, yeah.
It's hard because it's this accountability mechanism, but it's just such a signifier of everything that's wrong in terms of like performance and toxicity. And
it is. It's vaudevillian. You know, it's vaudevillian. It's performance. It's performative. It's really about an opportunity to bash the government. It's, you know, that 1 hour that's broadcast. Well, there's more that's broadcast, but it's broadcast. And I think that plays a big role in it as well, like the 24-hour news cycle and the broadcasting of Question Time. You know, it's not really Question Time because I can't stand up out of the blue and ask a question on behalf of my constituents.
And there's everything's a real process. Pre-prepared.
Yeah.
And it's all...
Yeah, there's a real process behind it.
So what have you thought about... You got elected.
Yeah.
Slim margin, hard
so
campaign.
Slim.
I was
so
there.
Scrutineering. I know you were there. I remember that.
Freezing my house. But you did it.
Yeah.
You became the federal member for Cowan. Mm. What has it been like? That was back in 2016. What's the experience been like? Do you like it?
I wish I was one of those people who could say, oh, I've loved every minute of it. And I hear people say that and I'm like, how could you love every minute of it? Like, I don't love the death threats.
Yes.
I don't love the you know, the toxicity on social media. I don't love the kind of the politics of politics. I do love the parliamentary work and the platform that it gives you to actually make that change. I do love the opportunity that I have to meet so many people. Mm-hmm. Just, and I'm not talking about celebrities or, you know, people on the front pages of magazines. I'm talking about the everyday.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about, you know, the single mum trying to raise 5 kids on her own who has also fled domestic violence. You know, I'm talking about the, you know, people who have started up businesses. I'm talking about people who have migrated to Australia to find a better future for themselves and for their children. I'm talking about, like, the, to me, the everyday heroes. I'm talking about, you know, the kids at school who have such amazing dreams and aspirations.
Idealistic view of this world,
beautiful.
Which should be really protected because...
So beautiful, right? And that to me is the real privilege of being a parliamentarian. It's not the travel and the you know, the the hotel rooms and the cars and all of that. It's actually that platform that it gives you to be able to share stories with people, everyday people, and gain some inspiration from that and hopefully inspire them too.
So you mentioned sort of like you were sold the idea. I shouldn't say sold because it's, you know, how I felt, and it's why I've gotten involved in politics, because I do see Parliament as a vehicle to make really systemic change in the lives of a really like a great number of people.
Yeah.
And I have a very, I really, your story resonates with me because my mum's a single mum as well. And I remember I spoke in the first episode of this second season about our own story and how I think a reason why I've become politically engaged is because I felt the impacts as like a 10-year-old on the parental like supplement from Centrelink going up or down. And I just can feel the impact, like a 10-year-old feeling the impact of public policy changing.
Right? I know.
So I understand the gravity of like the decisions that are being made on the hill in Canberra. You were told this is a place for you to make change. Do you feel like you've been able to make some change?
It's a vexed question, Alicia, if I'm honest. Like, I recently was awarded the MacKinnon Prize in emerging political leadership, and next week I'm doing the MacKinnon Oration, where we're talking about leadership and change. And, you know, it's a real honour to be recognised as a political leader who has made change, but it's not something that you reflect on daily, you know.
Yes.
you don't sit there and go, what is leadership? Am I a leader? Am I not a leadership? I think within the political system, there are a lot of challenges to making that change, especially when you are an opposition backbencher in one of the most marginal seats in the universe. The universe, people. Right. There's a kind of like almost a hierarchy, and you are at the bottom of that hierarchy, right?
Yeah.
You're told your job is just to keep your seat. And so it even impacts like the level of parliamentary work that you can do, because it's expected that all your time is spent
in your electorate.
In your electorate, keeping your seat, right?
Not even necessarily on constituent work, on like
campaigning.
Campaigning.
Exactly, yeah. And I find that incredibly frustrating. And for me, it's been an incredible challenge of, okay, well then, you know, there's this kind of this hierarchy where you've got the leadership team and the cabinet. So the government has the power and their ministers have the power, and then you've got the opposition, and there's this hierarchy of power and who gets to make decisions. And you kind of have to navigate that way to achieve the things that you want to achieve.
Yes.
And you find ways of doing that, whether it's, you know, putting up private members' motions and using the political process itself, or using your influence and your platform as a member of parliament to raise awareness of issues, to bring about change, or using your connections to bring people together so that they can pursue the things that make meaningful change. So, like, you know, I've been able to connect people who are working on different aspects in climate change, for example, to work on projects together.
Yes.
I've been able to connect people who are working on different aspects around victims of terrorism and trauma-informed counter-terrorism, bringing them working to work together. And so there are kind of different avenues that you need to use, especially if you're a political outsider, as I am. You haven't come from within that system. I often say, I cannot rewind my life and join Young Labor at 15.
Yes.
And the truth is, there would have been no place for me in Young Labor when I was 15. Mm-hmm. That's the truth. So the challenge is to find the ways to make change in ways that are available to you, and they're not necessarily the conventional ways.
How do you go with that tension? And I feel it. The reason why I want to bring it up is because I don't think it's not just found in politics. I feel it all the time in my work life, in my social life. We sort of alluded to it before we actually started recording today. You've come out recently with a different opinion on Christina Keneally's, the whole pre-selection. People will be probably familiar. It was in the media. But rather than talking about that issue, what's it like when you are part of a collective, you're part of a political party, and this can go to any collective. It could be someone's workplace or it could be someone's social group. I feel like a lot of women particularly really struggle when they have a different opinion, position to the collective and the impact that that has on them and their relationship with the people in that group.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that? Because often I'll just have like, I'll really feel this like you burning desire to express myself, but I know that it will have ramifications for me.
Yeah. And I think that's part of negotiating life, really, isn't it? Like in life, you choose your battles, you choose what you're going to put your efforts into. And we're fortunate that we're able to do that. We're fortunate that we have options, I guess. And I think for me in politics, there are a lot of things that you kind of go, okay, I can compromise on that. Okay, I can live with that. It may not sit with me 100%, but I can live with it. And then there are some things where I draw a line in the sand and I simply cannot abide. I simply cannot abide hypocrisy. Simply cannot. I have lost lifelong friendships over hypocrisy. It's my one big bugbear. I made a choice that I would speak up. And when I criticize, it's not malicious, and it's not meant to be malicious. It's because I see that there is a better pathway and that we can be better and that we have to hold ourselves to a standard that we expect of others. As politicians, as parliamentarians, as members of a party, as humans, as individuals, as members of any kind of group, you join a group or you become part of a group or you join a workplace because there is some kind of value alignment there. And I think it's your responsibility to raise those issues within the group as long as you feel safe to do so. Now, have I done myself any political favours by calling it out? Probably not, but I couldn't look myself in the mirror if I didn't. So you have to decide what you can live with as a human being and what risks you are going to take.
And I think that that's probably something that sometimes within these dynamics and dialogues people don't actually remember is that the person who perhaps is going against the group or really putting themselves out there with a contrary opinion has done the like risk analysis for themselves and they've decided that it's so important to them that they're going to proceed anyway.
Exactly. And you have to stay true to your values and who you are, and it's advice that I would give anyone in any pathway of life, whether it's politics or in any workplace or in any group that you join. The saddest thing would be to lose yourself and who you are and the things that have shaped you into being who you are.
Tell me about that parliamentary work, because you said you do love the parliamentary work. What are some of those things that, you know, since coming to Canberra, being in the halls of power, that you have really enjoyed and you've been sitting there and being like, wow, I'm fulfilled by this. This is good.
Yeah, for me, it's really the work of the committees. So I'm the deputy chair of law enforcement, and I've only recently been put onto the Parliamentary Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence and Security, even though it was my field of work for a good decade and a half. It took me 4 years to get onto that committee, and I fought for it, I will tell you. But I really enjoy that kind of that committee work where you can really look in depth at issues, because so much of politics is the three-word slogan and the three-second grab, right? But what goes on behind the scenes is really, really is this kind of in-depth policy analysis where you can – as the deputy chair of law enforcement, for example, I can instigate inquiries. I've instigated inquiries into our law enforcement capabilities to deal with cyber-enabled crime. I've instigated one into looking at the threat or risk of fake vaccine passports.
Wow.
And you know, what are we doing about those things? So it's where you're able to go, okay, I see an issue or a problem here, and I can actually use the committee process to look into this problem deeper. When I was on the economics committee, I raised, if someone in Cowan had any issues with banks or issues like that, I would raise them in inquiries as well. So that's the real part that I enjoy, is that kind of, and it's the bipartisan work.
Yes. And it's the work that unfortunately doesn't seem to, unless, and I'm like, sometimes it does get coverage maybe through like a 7:30 or a Four Corners. It will be elevated to that level once a lot of like a big piece of work and a really newsworthy piece of work has been done. But there's a lot of stuff that just doesn't really get disseminated through the media. And I think people just completely miss that all of this good, mostly bipartisan work is happening in these committees.
Mm, exactly. Because all they say is the tit for tat of politics. And it's because politics is really ruled by the election cycle, isn't it? You know, once you get elected, you're starting to plan for the next election.
Yes. Do you feel like, have you made good friends in politics?
Yeah, I have. I've made some really good friends who, they say that there's not many people you can trust. But I've made really good friends on both sides, you know, within the Labor Party itself and within the Labor caucus, but also on the other side, in the LNP government. It's difficult not to.
Yes.
Because you go away on trips with these people. You spend a lot of time with them in committees. You work closely with them in committees. And it's difficult not to. I don't know how people can go in with this kind of tribal mentality of you're the Libs and we're Labor and never going to talk to you or see you as another human being. I think when you take the time and the opportunity to get to know people on all sides of the parliamentary process and all sides of politics, you find more commonalities than you do differences.
And it's really funny because I've got friends who are Liberals and they will be friends that have had very similar lived experience to me. They've had their own trauma, they've had their own struggles, but for some reason, unbeknownst to me, they have chosen, they see something within the Liberal Party that really resonates with their values and how they want to change the world, I guess. And, you know, that's the part to me that I'm like, well, okay, interesting choice. But it's, you know, a lot of the time we are all working towards the same end and our means to get there are different.
Exactly, exactly. Well, you know, I think that's very true. I think the danger to that or the risk to that is the politics of ideology, and where the ideologies are so different and it becomes overwhelmed by the ideological approach, whether it's the ideological approach to climate change or higher education, that overtakes that kind of reasoned approach to policy.
Yeah. So moving forward, the next few years, many years of your political career, when you think about that, what do you want to achieve through the rest of your parliamentary career, whether that's 30 years or 3 years?
30? Oh, my goodness, Alicia. I'll be like one foot in the grave.
Like, I just want to body sit on the couch with some wine.
Yeah. No, I certainly don't see myself as a long-term career politician. I never have. And, you know, I'll be very honest with you. I regularly question whether I made the right choice in leaving my academic career and entering politics. It's a question that plagues me.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't like I wasn't making change before. I just kind of had to look back to see it. Like I had a not-for-profit, an NGO, that was changing lives every
day.
Am
I right to say it was called PAVE?
Yeah, PAVE, where we worked with young people to kind of harness their innovation and ingenuity to find ways of combating violent extremism and giving them positive pathways and positive choices. I still do a lot of that work with young people, actually. Even though it's not part of my kind of my politician day job, I still do it.
It's just hard. You only have so much time in the day, yeah, right?
But I always make time for young people. Yes. Always. Like even yesterday I had a young person come and I sat with him for coffee and he's still trying to figure out where his kind of political values lie. He's probably more liberal than Labor. And I'm like, yeah, I think you are. Mm. You know, I'm not here to try and convince you to join the Labor Party. I'm here to help you find your way. And in a way, in a place that you feel safe and where you feel your values align. You know, I do kind of question a lot. And there are days that are harder than other days, like, you know, when you get death threats and...
You have been the subject of, you know, I talk a lot about sexism and, you know, the toxic culture for women in Parliament House, but you have experienced pretty awful racism. Through your time.
Yeah, heaps. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I find it a little bit frustrating, I guess, that there's so much focus on sexual harassment, but racial harassment is not even considered or looked at. Mm. And it's pretty rife in Parliament. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's not just about the gender side of it. It's also about the fact that I'm a woman, yeah, but I'm also brown and also Muslim. It's so intersectional and I can't really separate those things. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's all part of that. Like I'm so sick and tired of being called exotic. Like what? Like an iguana?
Good God. All the time.
Right? So it's, you know, it's just those kinds of things. Like you wouldn't call an Anglo woman exotic, I get called exotic. And, you know, people say, oh, look at you in your exotic costume. It's not a costume. It's a dress that I bought from Tiger Lily. Like what, people? It's Australian made. Like, come on. So it's those kinds of things. And I don't see us really, there's not really a lot of attention to that.
Yeah.
I always say, you know what, guys, I am not a semicolon and.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get to go dot, 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 semicolon and, right? That's not me. I'm here for a reason. I need to be front and center along with everyone else. Mm-hmm. So that's a real struggle. Now, in terms of my political career, I certainly will not be there for the next 30 years. Certainly
let's just nip that one in the bud.
Let's that one off the table now. I never saw myself as having a long-term political career, but there are things that I want to achieve before I leave. I think really for me, the stuff around domestic violence as a survivor myself and real action on domestic violence, like it's all really nice for us to light candles in Parliament and shed a tear when there's another heinous, unnecessary, senseless murder of a woman. Or her children. But where is the substantive change? To me, a lot of the stuff that happens in Parliament is so tokenistic.
Yeah.
So tokenistic. Whether it's around domestic violence, whether it's around kind of anti-racism stuff as well, it's so tokenistic that I would like to actually see substantive change in those areas. I also want to deliver some things for the northern suburbs of Perth, specifically, you know, that 50% of people who live in the northern suburbs of Perth actually work in the southern suburbs.
Wow.
Yeah, so I want to build more livable communities.
Yes.
And a livable community to me is where people feel, have a sense of belonging, where they can work, play and live. And I mean, you know, Alicia, when we go out and we door knock or we're on the phones, we ask people these very kind of superficial questions about, I want to know what you care about. Is it education or jobs or this?
And, you know,
or
I think that speaks to, like, going back to just what you said about, you know, tokenism and practical change. I feel like my frustration looking at politics so much is that we just seem to, like, talk around this point where it's like, No, just have the actual conversation that you want to have without all this like cream on top.
Absolutely.
Like, what is the issue? What
delve can deep.
We? So exactly. What do you do on your calls?
So what I do, what I've actually found is because people won't. People go, oh, yeah, I guess I care about jobs. Oh, yeah, I guess I care about education. But I'll tell you what people really care about. Mm-hmm. Security. And okay. I'm not talking about national security. I'm talking about security in every sense of the word. And security for me, and I've actually written a book chapter about reconceptualizing security, it's about individual security, that sense of well-being that you have. When people say I care about jobs, what they're actually saying is they care about their job security, the security that they have in knowing that they can go to work, pay the bills, put food on the table. When they say they care about education, what they're actually saying is they care about the security in knowing that their kids have access mm-hmm. to good education and that their kids can pursue their dreams. When they say they care about health, what they're actually saying is they care about the security of knowing that if something befalls them, yes. there is a health system there that they will be looked after and not be out of pocket. That's what people care about, security.
You have, like, changed. You've answered a question that has been floating in my head ever since I started becoming engaged in politics because I thought it was so – I've always thought it was bizarre that we use these, like, quite amorphous terms in my mind to be, like, what are your priorities, jobs?
Exactly.
Like, I don't – it's just, like, not how people talk to each other
it's
or
not.
Think or
– It's not how people think. And when people want security, it's not just the security of jobs and education and health, and it's not in terms of, like, I want to be able to leave my home and the door unlocked. It's the security of knowing you belong, mm-hmm. of having a community that you belong to, of having that sense of kind of wellness – and well-being. And then there's, of course, the level of national security, and then there's the level of international security. But if we were to look at policy and the way that we develop policy in terms of individual security, community security and well-being, national security and international security, and kind of look at it like that, I think we would be able to have more rich mm-hmm. and substantial conversations with people, but we'd also be able to develop policy that actually speaks to those things that people care about.
Do you think that you will go back to your research?
Yes, 100%. 100% I will go back to doing what I was doing. I've still got like like 150,000 words of unpublished research
wow.
that needs to get published on terrorist profiling. I know, like, it's something that I think about every night. Oh, I've got to write that book about terrorist
You're
profiling.
And I think that, like, it troubles me a little bit that you reflect and you're like, you feel quite a lot of, pain's the wrong word, but like, you're sort of got this feeling of, oh, should I have done this? Should I have gone down this path? Because I think you're a demonstration of the fact that through life, like, life is a winding path and I think that we'll probably all sometimes question why did we go in this direction. But I do really, like, without getting too spiritual, like, I do think that things happen for a reason.
I agree.
I think that your personality and what you can do, you know, in the future, your future parliamentary career will leave a really important legacy on the cultural element, if anything, like, of just being able to have a conversation like this that is refreshing and not like these, not these evasive, like actually answering questions.
I hope so. Like, I often say I am the worst liar on earth. Like, I can't hide anything. Like, my face shows everything.
I couldn't do this thing that you see people do.
I can't
being
do
like,
that.
Listen to someone ask them a question and then be like, and you know, we hear about it a lot. It's like you get the answer, you get the question. It's in media training and stuff like that. And then pivot to what you actually
exactly.
want to say. I'm like, no,
I can't pivot. I'm the worst pivoter. I'm like Zoolander who can't turn left.
So good. I think that's what makes you so special. And the question we always end our interviews with is, young women particularly who have listened to this conversation and are feeling inspired and they think that they've been interested in politics, what's your advice for young women who are viewing Parliament and politics as a way to make change?
I would say to them, talk to someone. Because I wish that I had talked to someone, and I wish that there was me to tell me,
yes,
what to expect. So I would say talk to someone about what to expect. Do something else first. Like, live your life first. Politics is not going away. Mm-hmm. It will always be there for you as an option. And if you do decide to go into politics, never forget who you are or where you came from.
I think those are perfect words to leave us with, Anne. Thank you so much for joining in the House and in the Senate.
Thanks, Alicia.
In the House and in the Senate is recorded on the land of the Whadjuk people. This land was never ceded. It always was and always will be Aboriginal land. If you enjoyed this episode of In the House and in the Senate, please jump into your podcast app, subscribe and give me a quick rating and review. This will help the podcast reach more people and I will personally be incredibly grateful. Also, be sure to head over to the podcast Instagram at In the House in the Senate, where I'll be sharing content from our guests, throwbacks to my time in staffing and resources to help you get more involved in the political system. You can also follow my personal account at alicia.aikenradburn. Thanks for listening and speak to you next week.
Bye-bye. Goodbye to you. Bye.
Next question.